Will he or won't he? That is the question. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
It is great to be back with you, Barry. I just want to let people know, yes, I will catch the show archive up on the internet, www.principledpolicy.com. I'm a little behind. There's good reason why I'm behind, and just let people know at www.principledpolicy.com, you can hear every show we've ever recorded.
That's right, Chuck. I mean, and sometimes if they just listen live on the radio, they might be able to hear every show we've ever recorded, because sometimes we have to run some what we call golden oldies.
Oh, well, that happens.
Today's not one of those days. We are actually live coming to you. Well, we're actually not live. We're pre-recorded. I shouldn't lie about that.
Yeah, we're live.
We're live earlier in the week, connected with each other via Skype, making radio magic.
That's right. We're what they used to call on television, live on tape. If you ever heard that phrase in the early days of television, like in the 60s, this television program was presented live on tape. In other words, it was done before a live audience, but it's recorded.
That's right. That's it. So, but anyhow, you know, there are a lot of things that, you know, we're looking at that, today is going to be an interesting day. You know, this is the week. Obviously, Chuck, you know, we're recording this a little bit earlier in the week, but we've already had now, the president is now firmly established in his office. You know, we went through the inauguration. There were no major incidents. We survived the quote unquote women's march, the, you know, canned angst protest marches that occurred across the country over the last weekend. And, you know, nationally and in local areas, we're gearing up for the March for Life, as this week was, you know, the 44th observance. Yeah, 44 years, Chuck, 44 years of having to work under the unconstitutional Roe versus Wade decision, which made abortion, and I don't want to say legal, made it acceptable by law in our culture. It's not legal because the taking of defenseless unborn life, it can never be legal because it violates God's law. But in our temporal throwing off antinomian hate God culture, and I think, you know, since I mentioned the Women's March, I think that's a really good example of what I'm talking about here. You know, we basically delude ourselves into thinking that we can have all this control and that there are no consequences for it. But, Chuck, I think there are some major consequences. I mean, 44 years of abortion being allowed in this country have had some significant consequences that we're really starting to feel after this first generational cycle has passed, and we're now into the second generational cycle of this. And you can see that from the way our economy is weak, the fact that we bemoan our schools and we don't have, you know, people going into, or don't have enough people to fill highly technical jobs or to even fill menial jobs. And so therefore we have immigration, and much of it is illegal immigration. And of course that spins off into the, oh, we need to normalize illegal immigration because, well, employers need all this, you know, ready source of labor.
Well, they need a ready source of cheap labor. That's the bottom line in this thing. You know, I always laugh about, we need this guest worker visa program to get all these computer programmers in here. We got lots of computer programmers in the United States of America. Lots of people who, in fact, have left the profession because they can't find a job. Now, how are all these guest worker visas being issued to people? Well, the reason that they're being issued is because companies like Disney can hire a guest worker at a fraction of the cost of a American citizen worker. And how do I know that's true? Well, there was a big kerfluffle last year because Disney fired a bunch of their IT people. That's internet technology information. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, information technology people, which is basically your computer gurus. They fired a bunch of people and made a condition of their severance packages that they train their replacement guest workers, the people yes. who would be taking their place, and not only that, but sign a no-tell clause in their contracts. They're not allowed to talk about it, or they lose their severance. And in fact, if they've already been issued the severance, they have to pay it back. Well, what does this tell you, A, about Disney Corporation? Folks, the next time you see one of these smiley, happy ads to, that basically exploit your children to get you, to try to get you to have your arm twisted into bringing your kids to Disney, remember what they're doing to American citizen workers. They're replacing them with foreign guest workers who really don't need to be here. This from a company who, by the way, it's now cost $100 to go to the Magic Kingdom for a day for an adult. I'm sorry. The last time I was at Disney, there wasn't anything there that was worth $100 for the day. So,
no, absolutely not. But absolutely not. But you know, Chuck, but that these actually are the natural consequences of a pro-death view. You know, when you basically have eradicated over 60 million, and okay, let's make sure everybody understands that number, 60
right.
million human beings from your culture, or 1/5 of our entire population of the United States, Chuck, 1/5. And folks, that 60 million is U.S. That's not worldwide. That's just here in this country. We've eliminated 1/5 of our population. Now, if you want to put that in perspective, that would be like you and me, Chuck, since we both have, you know, 3 kids and a wife. We've got 5 people in the house. That's as if one of those 5 people weren't there anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, that they either didn't exist or we killed them.
Yes.
That's what you got to think about, folks. I mean, look around you. For every 5 people you see, there should be 6 there. That's some of the real costs of abortion. And you know, we recognize this. You know, we have the Sanctity of Human Life Sunday observance, which was last weekend. We have the March for Life that's going to go on Friday in D.C. And, you know, Chuck, I'm just going to reiterate for everybody's purposes, you know, I'm pro-life, very much so, and I work for a lot of pro-life causes. I do a lot of the legislative work for a lot of the pro-life groups in Ohio. But I really look at the whole effort of March for Life as being something that, honestly, I don't see the bang for the buck out of it. I see a lot of people going to and allowing politicians in D.C. to be able to court them by, you know, holding receptions and everything else. And of course, certain pro-life statewide groups make a big deal out of pumping up how important they are by, oh, you know, we're helping to host this reception with these elected officials, who then mostly never turn around and never do anything about it. Now, this cycle, something has changed, but and you could, if you want to be charitable, you could say, well, because of all these years of all the marches and stuff, people have gotten the message. It's like, no, it's all the years of people back home changing minds and getting people to vote pro-life that has changed that message. But I see that, you know, a lot of these people will come from all over the country, Chuck, and, you know, people in Ohio are probably, you know, this, we're recording this on Wednesday, so probably tomorrow they're going to be boarding buses, and doing caravans, et cetera, and they're going to be pointing their noses toward Washington, D.C. to go out there to jostle in with the big crowd, to stand out and hold the signs and hear the speeches from the politicians and the luminaries. And in an effort to end abortion and to create a pro-life culture. And what usually happens, Chuck, during that day when it comes to the impact it has on the culture at large?
Well, look, what you think about a number of things impacts directly how you're going to act it out in culture.
Well, that's true. That's true. But I'm just talking about the immediacy. I mean, does the country, you know, everybody, just like, unlike with the moon landing, we don't have all eyes, you know, riveted on their television sets to see what's happening with the March for Life.
No.
But if somebody did flip on their television, what would they see?
Well, they wouldn't see the March for Life.
They wouldn't see the pro-lifers. What they would see would be all the Planned Parenthood and the Women's March. I mean, gee, after this last weekend, that's all you saw on television were the women's marches. Women's marches. You know, the pink hats and the less, you know, able to be shown accoutrement and signage that some of these women had put out here. All, you know, supposedly in a opposition to Trump and an empowering of women, except for the fact that the Women's March on D.C. this last weekend didn't allow any women's groups that were pro-life, because you had to be a card-carrying pro-abort in order to be considered part of their club. But here in the March for Life this weekend, now, of course, will there be as big a numbers? Well, maybe, maybe not. Doesn't really matter, because they won't get, except in pro-life media, which is some of your alternative media stuff, right, like LifeSite and all these other news outlets.
CNS,
they're the only
news,
ones who are going to cover this, because what the major news networks, the ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, and God help them, even Fox News, are going to cover are all the pro-abort opposition protesters. Keep your hands off my body, keep abortion, blah, blah, safe, legal, and rare.
The same
blah,
old
blah,
hackneyed
blah.
Arguments over and over and over, yeah.
Oh, the old hackneyed arguments all over and over and over again. So I've always posited, and I did this, I actually spoke to a pro-life group up in the northern part of the state last weekend, and I've posited to them, I said, listen, folks, I said, I said, show of hands, how many are planning to go to the march? Well, in a room of about 100 people, maybe 15 or so put their hands up. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. How many of you would like to go to the march, but for some reason you just can't get it coordinated? And then a bunch of hands went up. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. For those of you who can't go, and maybe even for some of those of you who are thinking about going, why don't you do something that's going to have much more of an impact for pro-life? Why don't you take the money that you'd be spending to get on the bus or buy food or lodging or the time you take off from work or whatever it might be? I said, you know, I roughly just conservatively say $200 to $250 is what you're going to spend for that little trip to D.C. and back, maybe more. But let's just say conservatively $200 to $250. Why don't you turn around and write a check right now to one of the pro-life, like, and of course at that speech, there were groups that had booths on the side, and one of them was a pregnancy care center. I said, why don't you turn around and write that check right over there to that pregnancy care center and help them actually impact the cause of life by encouraging and supporting women who are abortion-minded to keep their babies. I said, that's going to do so much more good in the culture than going to D.C. to give our enemies a photo op.
Now, Barry,
maybe I'm way off.
You're not.
Mark,
you're not.
But, you know, folks, I mean, if we're going to do, I mean, people are willing, if they feel like they're getting something out of it, which I believe a lot of the people who go to the March for Life believe are getting something out of it. You know, it's exciting. You go to D.C., you meet with your congressman, and, you know, you're among all your friends, and, you know, there's this, like, strengthening of the bond, and we can go out there and make our voices heard. And it's like, I don't care about hearing your voices. What I care about is getting the work done. So let's get the work done. Let's support the pregnancy care centers. Let's support the pro-life groups who are out there working in the trenches every day to get the legislators to change their minds. And, of course, as we just saw, Chuck, in D.C., that's starting to happen. President Trump, one of the first acts he's done in office as president, is to reinstitute what's called the Mexico City policy. And that was a policy under Reagan that was then repealed by Democrat presidents and then reinstituted by Republican presidents and then repealed again by Democrat presidents to prevent any federal dollars from going to organizations overseas, foreign organizations, that provide or promote abortion services. And so Trump signed that into law that we're going to reinstitute the Mexico City policy and we're not going to give any more money out foreignly to those entities. Well, the other thing that just happened, this is Wednesday. This happened yesterday, Chuck, on Tuesday of this week. And that is that the House, now, okay, hear me carefully. It's not over with yet. It's just the House vote.
Right.
But the House voted fairly overwhelmingly to permanently ensconce what's called the Hyde Amendment into federal law. And the Hyde Amendment basically says that tax dollars cannot be used to fund abortions, period. That gets at your... But the point is, you know, they have this, and then the pro-abort community and the pro-abort hangers-on and your bureaucracies always find ways of getting around it, you know, and still funneling federal money through grants to these abortion providers or to the medical practices that are part and parcel of the abortion industry. I don't think that's going to happen this time around. It just depends if Senate can, Mitch McConnell has got enough moxie to muster up the votes that they need. And I don't think that they need more than a simple majority on this. So if he can keep his Senate caucus in line, we might be able to actually start peeling back and undoing the damage that has been done by abortion providers, whether it's Planned Parenthood or whether it's the private ones like Haskell and Dayton or Preterm in Cleveland or Women's Med Center. They always have these lovely sounding names.
Yes.
Up in the Toledo area. You know, if they stop the money going to these folks, then we can really do a great deal of work locally in the states in closing down the regulations in order to basically, as we're seeing in some states, these abortion providers just go out of business because it doesn't become profitable for them anymore. Because it is really for them, Chuck, I don't think it's so much ideology as it is greed. When you can get $600 to $800 to $1,200 for performing an abortion, and you know that the government, especially with people who are on low income, the government will help pay for it in some way, shape, or form, that's lucrative.
It is. Well, look, the whole thing with the exposure, what was it, last year or year before last, of the group down in Texas who essentially exposed the sale of spare parts.
Oh, yes. Center for Medical Progress.
Yeah.
Dave DeLighten's group, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, all you got to do is look at what was the reaction. Well, bogus indictments was the reaction for a laughable charge of illegal recording. Well, look, journalists for years, we've talked about this on previous shows, journalists for years have used those methods, you know, hidden camera and that kind of thing. There was something I saw on this the other day, and this is a little segue, so I'm going to get back to it, I promise.
Sure,
but I saw something the other day about the fact that what had happened was somebody had a hidden camera in a Planned Parenthood clinic and was basically it was made clear that the women involved being examined by and I think given abortions in this Planned Parenthood clinic were being human trafficked.
Yes,
it was absolutely. It was absolutely clear. It was clear as anything that this is what was happening, and Planned Parenthood was openly discussing how they were going to cover it up. Now, when they got busted by this, they said, "Okay, we're going to retrain everybody so they'll recognize human trafficking." And a former director of a Planned Parenthood clinic went to one of these training sessions. Do you know what the training was?
No, I probably wouldn't be surprised at what it would be, though.
The training was how to recognize when you're on camera.
Oh, okay.
Now, that shows you the attitude. They don't think they're doing anything wrong. And this is, honestly, this should not be shocking, Barry. The idea that you can kill human beings, innocent, judicially innocent, not innocent, you know, we look, we're Calvinists. I'll be quite up front. There is no such thing as an innocent human being, but there is a judicially innocent human being.
Convicted, why I don't say innocent. That's the reason why I never say innocent, Chuck. I say it's defenseless unborn life.
Yes, exactly. It takes too much explaining. But the fact is, if you will kill someone who is guilty of no crime for the simple reason of convenience or any number of perceived things, it might make me sick. Well, it is going to make you sick. Carrying a baby can make you sick, or it's going to have a bad life because I can't provide for it. Well, there are lots of people who want to provide for that child. You're willing to do anything. If you can murder and then call it something else, you will do anything and call it something else. You really don't have any limits. The only limits you have are the artificial ones you've built for yourself, because if you're willing to commit murder, you're willing to do anything else. That's the bottom line. And that's the question you asked me before about culture. The fact is, you know, we talked about the fact that at the March for Life, what's going to get reported is if somebody does something goofy that's in the crowd, and there will be goofiness. You put that many people together, somebody's going to do something stupid. But that being said, that's what will get reported, and then the counter protests will get reported, and they will do what they do best, and that is frame pictures so that the crowd looks small. I don't want to get into the whole controversy about how many people showed up in D.C. to see Trump get inaugurated. It's very clear to me that not as many people showed up in D.C. to see Trump get nominated as happened with Barack Obama, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And I'm going to
because people had to actually take time off work and spend their own money to go see Trump inaugurated versus getting paid by organizers to go see Obama.
Yeah, and I saw an article the other day that made perfect sense to me. First of all, conservatives work. Liberals basically take the day off to go do whatever they want to do. It's a glittering generality. I realize that, I don't want to make the case, but the fact is, it's easier for people who aren't working to go to inaugurations in the middle of the week than it is for people who work and own their own businesses and are basically trying to get ahead. And the fact is that Barack Obama got elected by people. If you look at a radius within a couple hundred miles, which is an easy drive, of Washington, D.C., you have Maryland, New York City. You have all these liberal enclaves, even parts of Virginia. You have a lot of liberal enclaves where it's an easy drive to get there. And let's face it, it was the first black president of the United States. A lot of people wanted to be there for that. On the other hand, who elected Trump? Well, they weren't Marylanders. Virginia was pretty evenly split. A lot of the liberal enclaves around there either went Trump barely or basically voted blue. So you don't have the same crowd to draw from. Let's face it, very few people got on a plane to fly to D.C. Now, we know people who did. Let's all go to the inauguration.
I saw photos on my Facebook feed from a lot of my friends. Oh, look at D.C. It's D.C. It's D.C. Oh, we're going to all the fun things. And it's like, okay, that's great. Have fun. Do that. Me, I got better things to do with my life. So that's okay.
Yeah, it's a dumb thing to say, you know. But however, I did see a statistic that it was probably the second most viewed inauguration ever. And that includes internet, television. We have a different kind of media than we've had even in the recent past. There were dozens of opportunities to live stream the entire inauguration. Okay, ask me if that was around in 2001 when George W. Bush took the oath of office. The answer is no. I can remember, Barry, at 9/11, I was T1'd into a into an internet service provider because I was in the same building with them, and we couldn't get a signal when the planes crashed into the towers.
Right.
That tells you how overloaded the internet was. Now, can that happen again? Sure it can. But technology has marched on, and people's, you know, our culture has marched on. We depend on the internet for a lot of stuff, which is the reason why the new media has essentially been is the David that has been able to slay the old style liberal dominated media, that particular Goliath, because that's exactly what you're witnessing. And when you see stuff out there where we've been talking today before we went on air, we were talking today about a story that's out there. CNN is calling out Trump for claiming that there was basically millions of illegal votes. Well, guess what? You know, they say there's absolutely no proof. Okay, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, Barry. This is one of the problems we have with the news. Okay, when allegations of fraud come out, what does the news media do? They immediately rally behind the candidates they like and say, there's no chance that this has... there's no proof whatsoever. Now, they don't do any actual research. They don't
research.
Go out...
Absolutely not.
They
no,
don't go out and investigate. They simply say there's no proof. Well, okay... Here's the problem, Barry. You've got states like California, and we've got this awful, and I remember railing against and campaigning against it in the mid-90s, this awful motor voter bill, this motor voter law, that basically says when you go in, you can register to vote. I don't have a problem with that, but there are states like California who are automatically registering you to vote when you get a driver's license. In fact, what they ask you is, you have to tell them that you don't want to register to vote when you go in to apply for a driver's license. What does that mean? They're handing out driver's license willy-nilly to illegals all over the place in California. And I will tell you, the number is in at least the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, that they've handed a driver's license to. And the fact is, they get registered to vote when they do that. If you can really look at that situation and say, oh, I'm not worried that people who are not eligible aren't voting, then I know people who have land they'd love to sell you. It's in a swamp. There's some other guys I know who were selling some cliff face property. Because you are gullible if you think that people who have been registered to vote through motor voter aren't voting illegally.
Oh, no, that's true.
What's the extent of it? Nobody knows because nobody's investigating. So you can't sit here.
Our Ohio Secretary of State is all over motor voter.
Oh, he loves it.
Wanting it. Loves it.
Well, I can tell you my voter registration got changed when I moved from Franklin to Licking County by simply going in and changing my driver's license.
Yeah.
So that's... you know, I was like, I need to contact somebody about, you know, who do I contact? And they're like, oh, this will be done for you. Sure enough, I got a new voter registration card in the mail.
Oh, of course.
I don't mind that. However, it's a frightening, you got to think about the consequences. Everything has a consequence. And one of the consequences is you are absolutely going to register people who are ineligible to vote.
There's no doubt about that.
It's inevitable, and they're going to vote. Now, what these guys are talking about, well, these cases where people go around state to state to state to state and vote, you know, live in a tri-state area and vote in all three states, they're talking about how rare that is. If you'll remember, one of the things that came out from the John Podesta's emails was the fact that, you know, he said openly, one of the most open things that he said was, they've got a driver's license, they can vote. And in fact, I think O'Keefe got a film done that showed people talking about how to bus people around in multi-state areas, bus them around and have them vote in all those states. The same people. So does it happen? Oh, you bet it does. Is it enough to throw an election? Nobody knows, because nobody knows what the numbers are and nobody knows how it's all done, except the operatives who are doing the job. And the media will not investigate it, because to investigate it would mean that the people that they're supportive of will get embarrassed. That's the bottom line. We can't embarrass the people. Therefore, what do? We attack Trump. Well, CNN's on the ropes with Trump.
Of course.
And this is their way of trying to fight their way off the ropes. And honestly, this whole thing with the that we talked about earlier, the crowd, Kellyanne Conway, I think, stuck her foot in her mouth with that whole alternative facts thing.
Well, you know, the one thing that has done, it has greatly increased the interest in an old classic book, Chuck. And I think it's kind of funny, because I saw that yesterday, that, you know, when you go out there on social media, they always give you the things that are trending at the moment. And one of the hot things that are trending right now is George Orwell, because his book 1984, people are scrambling to find a copy of the book because of the idea of alternative facts.
Yeah.
And I think it's funny, because, you know, my son runs a little eBay business, and we've actually got a first edition copy of 1984 up on our eBay store.
Oh, that's worth a couple bucks.
Trust me, as soon as I saw that trending line, I went over to our eBay store, changed the title a little bit, and added the word alternative facts. I've had 4 offers on the book. It had zero movement since he'd put it up. We put the words alternative facts in the title. We've had 4 offers on the book.
Look, here are the facts, Barry. And let me tell you something. I'm teaching a Sunday school class, and one of the things that have popped up is the kind of postmodern idea. I saw a cartoon the other day on Facebook, and it was on somebody who thought they were posting some kind of theological, deep thought.
Exactly.
And it turned out it's one of Jack Handy's deep thoughts. If you recall Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy on Saturday Night Live, just silly non sequiturs. This was a silly non sequitur. And what it is two men facing one another. And written on the ground between them is something that can be construed as either the number 6 or the number 9. And as they look at each other, they say, "See, yes. we can agree to disagree on what this means, because it really, you know, the gist was it really doesn't. It means whatever you want it to mean."
Wrong.
That's exactly what I said.
It has a fixed meaning, and one person's right and the other person's wrong. It's not the question of your perspective. It's the question of what the truth is.
Okay, and what I post, I shared that, and I said, wrong. Here's what I said. Absolutely. This number on the pavement has a meaning.
Yes, the
meaning was set by the person who put it there. He had something in mind, either a 6 or a 9. That means he defined what the truth was about this number.
Right.
So there is a true interpretation and a false interpretation of the number. One of these men is right, and the other one is wrong. It's not that, see, we can disagree and both of us are right. No, you're not. Now, I had one of my fellow elders actually wrote me and said, it could also be a G. And I said, well, you may think you monkey wrenched my thing here, but you didn't. You actually, so maybe the guy wrote a G for some reason, a lowercase G.
Yeah, that's good.
But I said, the fact is that there is a definition of truth in this case, and one of them has it and the other one doesn't. That's where we are, Barry. We've been told for so long that, it's all a matter of perception, when it isn't. There is an absolute truth. And
yes, there is.
The meaning of things that are written, this is what's wrong with postmodernism. the nobody knows what the author meant when he wrote them. Therefore, the all the interpretation is up to the reader. No, it's not. Words mean things, and one of the things that we're losing in our society, I was noticing, I like to read older books. And one of the things you notice is the richness of the language. And we're losing that because we're going to such simple terms. I've heard seen people just completely get the meaning of words completely. You are not using that word correctly. You may think you may,
or it's the old Princess Bride meme from Inigo Montoya. I do not think that word means what you think it does.
Yes, I do not think that word means what you think it means. We have lost the ability, and I've known people who've used a word that they think they understand, and I'm like, you really should get a dictionary and look that up, because that doesn't mean I understand what you're trying to say, but not from the words you're using, but simply because I know the thread of your thought. This is one of the things we're losing. We are losing the idea that there's absolute truth, that authors have a meaning, and they're the ones who set the meaning of what they've written. Now, yes. You and I, Barry, are very adept at reading bureaucraties.
Oh, aren't we, though?
And what do you find written usually in a lot of bureaucraties documents?
Besides wiggle room for the agency to get out from under it when they don't want to apply to it?
They use words carefully to create an ambiguous document. In other words, a document that does not have a clear meaning. But in order to do that, you have to create something that's almost impossible to read, because most stuff written in bureaucraties is impossible to read. Because you get in it and you start reading it, and I go, what does this mean? What is the concrete meaning of this? There isn't one. It means whatever's advantageous to the agency you're writing it for.
Yeah.
So
that's basically it.
So in that case, instead of having a postmodern reader, you've got a postmodern writer.
Yes.
So I don't want to make the case that everybody means exactly what they say when they write something. No, they don't.
No, and there is intentional obfuscation too. I mean, you sometimes people will write one thing to mean something else or to hide a meaning, and that happens. Especially legislation. I mean, that's the reason why sometimes I get very frustrated, because I look at a piece of legislation that somebody else has written, and I'm sitting there like, wait a minute, okay, I see what they're trying to get at here. Opening a loophole over here so they can do something else a little bit later on. But you know what, Chuck? It's like playing a long game. You have to understand what your goal is at the end in order to figure out what the steps are to get there. The people who start with the steps and think, well, I'll just do this step and then I'll figure out where I go to for the next step, lose. They lose. I'll just be quite frankly, in politics and in strategy and everything else, you lose. You start from your goal and you work your way backwards. Okay, what's your ultimate goal? If our ultimate goal is to, and let's take the case of pro-life, if our ultimate goal is to end abortion, we can't just throw up anything. We have to say, okay, we have to end abortion. So we have to figure out that's our goal. So what does that goal look like? And then what steps do we have to take to get there? Now, I'm not necessarily advocating an incrementalist approach, but I'm saying that you can't just immediately throw down, after we've spent here, like I said, we're now recognizing and marching in the 44th year of Roe versus Wade. You can't just go down and say, well, we're just going to end it all tomorrow. That's very similar to some other things that we're going to talk about that whole idea of you don't unbuild a dam in a day. Because that dam's been up there for years, for 44 years, and you try to eliminate it in a day, what happens, Chuck?
Well, you create havoc downstream. What you do is you create destruction and death downstream.
You create more destruction and death. But if you figure out the way of, okay, here's what we really need to do is X, Y, and Z, and these steps have to follow on each other, but in order to get to Z, we have to actually have Y, and in order to have Y, we have to do X. you know, that's called strategy. That's called a long plan. And you can see it because I hate to say it, but as much as people want to think that the left is all like reactionary, et cetera, they're not. They have a long plan. They work these things out. They, you know, take the homosexual rights movement. I mean, back in the early 80s, a book came out called After the Ball.
Yes.
It basically was the blueprint for
it was
what
the plan.
We now face, which is the legalization of homosexual marriage, the mainstreaming of perversion, and the suppression of the Christian worldview. Folks, they had a long plan, and they knew what steps they needed to take, including using the rules for the Saul Alinsky type of actions of, you know, protest and derision of their opponents, et cetera, forcing the emotionalistic views, falsifying data and information to make themselves more sympathetic. Folks, it all happens. Now, we who are Christian believers would not do things like falsify data and things of that nature, not intentionally at least. We may requote somebody whose data turns out to be false.
Yeah.
And that's sad because that's, you know, basically sloppy research on our part. We should be more diligent because study to show yourself approved doesn't just go to the scriptures alone, Chuck.
Well,
that's a call on all areas of our lives as believers is to study to show ourselves approved that we can rightly handle not just the word of truth, but we can rightly handle anything that God puts in our hands.
One of the things we have to do as Christians is to positively. And what I mean by that is actively and positively eschew the use of logical fallacy, if you will, and false data and selective reporting and that kind of thing. I know, Barry, before we went on air, we were discussing a recent use
yes.
of selective reporting of evidence.
Absolutely.
In order,
and I'm glad you're going right there.
Yeah, I thought you might use that segue because this is a big problem. People who are so desperate to win the argument that they're willing to do anything. The end justifies the means, if you will. They're willing to do anything to get people over on their side. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to you because that's exactly.
Well,
what we're seeing.
What we're talking about is probably the penultimate issue that drove a large portion of the electorate to the polls this last November, and that is the appointment of justices to the United States Supreme Court, Chuck.
Yep.
And the question is, will he or won't he, i.e. Donald Trump, will he or won't he appoint or nominate, excuse me, he doesn't do the appointing, he does the nominating, the Senate does the appointing. Will he or won't he nominate to the highest bench in our country, the United States Supreme Court, jurists who are pro-life, strict constructionists, and who would, rule justly and in the fear of God, really. And I think that's a lot, especially of the Christian conservatives who supported Trump's candidacy, that's what they believed, was that the whole idea had to be that Trump would give them a better chance of getting pro-life justices on the Supreme Court who would overturn Roe v. Wade, who would rescind that decision of the court. And again, that's what it was. It was an opinion, a decision of the court. It's not law. It's not just. But, you know, for 44 years, we've had it in place, and pro-lifers and others were looking to who would be the one who might appoint justices who would have that judicial temperament. Well, Donald Trump got elected in large part because of that, and that's great, and now he has the opportunity, and it was just announced yesterday, that Trump will be naming his first nominee to the Supreme Court next week. Now, if you remember during the campaign, Trump had put out a list of about 24 different jurists, both at the federal and at state levels, that his team had decided were at least a good start on having a list to work from of potential nominees should Trump ultimately win the presidency, which he did. So now it's time for the payoff, right, Chuck? Well, not so fast, yeah. Because there's an awful lot of things that can happen on the way to a nomination. And one of the things that are happening is, of these 24 people, the first two who were supposedly front runners, according to I'm not sure what sources, but supposedly people close to the Trump organization or the Trump's transition team for president, you know, the names of Diane Sykes, who is a Court of Appeals Justice for the Seventh Circuit, and Bill Pryor, who's an 11th Circuit Appeals Court Justice, were floated out there early as those were like the highest likelihood candidates. Well, we had a big problem with Diane Sykes because it was very much clear from all of her decisions, and these are fairly unambiguous. I mean, it was going across the fruited plain, Chuck, that Diane Sykes was not pro-life, and that she definitely was not in favor of religious liberties. So most people don't want Diane Sykes to be one of Trump's picks, and that may very well be, you know, that the transition team and the brain trust inside the Trump organization, inside President Trump's inner circle, I should say, may be hearing that because she's kind of fallen off the radar now. Bill Pryor, there were a number of groups, including some pro-life groups, the state pro-life, you know, official organization in Ohio, came out with a social media post and stuff, kind of doing the indirect, but, you know, hat tipping that we like Bill Pryor and we would support him. But you and I both know from our position as constitutionalists, as strict constructionists, and as religious liberty believers in religious freedom, Bill Pryor's not our guy.
No, he's not.
He may have been fairly decent on a couple of three rulings in the 11th Circuit on pro-life issues, but really, when it gets right down to it, Pryor has not shown judicial restraint. He's not an originalist. He's a judicial activist, and the sad part about it is that he was the justice who, well, he was the attorney
federal
general,
attorney AG.
Of Alabama, who basically railroaded the state Supreme Court Chief Justice off the bench. That state Supreme Court Chief Justice, Roy Moore. He of the Ten Commandments display. And when Moore was Chief Justice the first time, and I say that because he's been Chief Justice twice now.
And removed twice.
And removed twice. So when the first time around, he put up a monument of the Ten Commandments in the Alabama Supreme Court building. And Pryor's attorney general fought him on it and got it removed and actually got him censured and off the bench.
Yeah, at the behest of George W. Bush.
Right. And funny thing is, after that was all over with, Bill Pryor gets appointed to the U.S. Court of Appeals. Oh, what a surprise.
The payoff.
No quid pro quo there. So there we go. But, you know, he barely made confirmation to the 11th Circuit, Chuck. So even if Pryor, if the Trump transition team, the Trump team loses their collective minds and decides that Bill Pryor's a great guy, it's a real question of whether or not he's going to get approved. He's a mixed bag. Let's just put it that way. As a matter of fact, when that list first came out, you and I were going over it, and I said, guess who's on this list? Because we were very familiar with him and his background. Of course, people were familiar, or like slightly familiar, I should say. I guess, you know, a lot of people don't study this the way some of us do. We're familiar with a couple of others, like Mike Lee, who's the Utah senator, who's, you know, a conservative. They knew those people, but most people didn't know anybody on this list. But the one name that's now popped up that is very interesting is the name of Neil Gorsuch. Now, Gorsuch is an appeals court justice for the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And his the bubbling up of his name as a front runner has created a lot of shall we say, heat. You have some in the pro-life community who are screaming that Gorsuch is not pro-life, including Andy Schlafly, who is the son of Phyllis Schlafly, formerly of the you know, Eagle Forum. And that's an interesting side note that we'll go into a little bit later. We won't have time for it this moment. But so Schlafly is out here, and Schlafly's an attorney. And Schlafly has put out an analysis of all these Supreme Court nominees on the PSEagles.com website. So you can go over there and look at it. But I looked at what he said about Neil Gorsuch. And I'd also looked at some other points about Gorsuch, because, you know me, I don't necessarily just go from one source. I start looking around, and sure enough, there is, let's say, a difference of opinion between Andy Schlafly and another well-known jurist by the name of Ed Whelan, who is also an attorney and who's well-known in conservative circles. And so Schlafly puts this out on PS Eagles about the nominee Supreme Court. He says, basically, right up in front, Neil Gorsuch, not pro-life. He has written about abortion using only the terminology of pro-aborts without any reference to the unborn child. And Chuck, you know, that was the first thing that stopped me, because, as you and I both mentioned, we're kind of policy wonks. We kind of read into this stuff and we know what it says. I got to just say, Andy Schlafly, I think, is trying to pick a fight where no fight exists on this, because what a judge usually does, if he's issuing an opinion, he can write in one way, but if he's referencing the law, well, Chuck, in most jurisdictions, when you come to the issue of life and abortion, the terminology that is used is not unborn child. It's fetus. It's product of conception. It's embryo. Those are the terms that are used in law. I know. I work in it every day. So basically saying that he's written using only the terminology of pro-aborts, basically that's not a condemnation necessarily of Gorsuch per se. That's a condemnation of our current laws that have been formed since Roe v. Wade. And I know that's a fight here in Ohio we're going to be taking on about redefining things in our statutes and in our administrative code regarding life, because most of that stuff was written in 1975 in Ohio, which is within 2 years after Roe v. Wade was decided. And so we have the terms product of conception and fetus, and we define fetus in code as, you know, being... was it 12 weeks after the last known menstrual cycle? So basically, we don't even recognize the unborn child even as a fetus for maybe the first 8 to 10 weeks of its development in Ohio law, which is one of those things that most pro-lifers don't even know about. But that's because of the way we define things. So here we go. So here's Schlaff. And he's talking about all this pro-life, and he brings up this case that came out of the Tenth Circuit back in 2007, Pino versus the United States, and basically he blasts Gorsuch because that he, you know, that he didn't say that he didn't think that the non-viable fetus had the same rights as a viable fetus unless the Oklahoma Supreme Court, this was a case coming out of Oklahoma in that circuit, specifically found rights for the non-viable fetus. And then Schlafly blasts Gorsuch by saying, rather than render a pro-life ruling, Gorsuch punted this issue to the Oklahoma Supreme Court for it to decide. Well, then you go over to Ed Whelan's analysis of what Andy Schlafly has been saying about this. Oh, and this is part two. So I got to get back to part one, because part one's the one. So Whelan is writing at National Review on their website, nationalreview.com. I would suggest we'll link to all these things, that we go and look at both of these and read it, because as I'm reading it and I go back and I look at some of these cases and read the language, I really have found that it seems to me, and I'm just going to state from my personal position, that I don't believe that Andy Schlafly's analysis holds water. I don't believe. I believe he's being disingenuous. I believe he's only telling you part of the story of these cases. And when you do a fuller analysis, you find a completely different model here. Now, I really am not sure what Schlafly's angle is on this, but he's got a number of pro-life leaders. I know some in Ohio. I've seen it on their Facebook pages. Oh, we can't support Gorsuch for... And I'm looking at it because, Chuck, as I'm reading it, Gorsuch is doing exactly what we would as constitutionalists want him to do. He said, no, we're not going to decide this case. We're going to send it back to the state Supreme Court because exactly. It's a state decision to make. And guess what? The state Supreme Court made the right this pro-life decision. Now, if Gorsuch was such an adherent to stare decisis and the rule of law, they would have had to have ruled on that issue in light of Roe v. Wade, in light of et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And most likely, as one jurist of a number, and I don't know how many are on the Tenth Circuit, it may be 13, it may be 12 or 9. Each circuit has a different number of jurists. I know the Sixth has 13 on it. He'd be one vote out of 13, and most likely it would be a pro-abort decision. Kicking it back to the state Supreme Court in Oklahoma actually was a pretty smart move.
Yeah, it was.
it was a strict constructionist move. It was a constitutionalist move.
Look,
and it resulted in a pro-life decision coming out.
Well, in
so
the,
yeah. Tell me, please, how and why that could be so bad. Now, and of course, that really is what Whelan gets down to on that case. You know, he busts him for that and says, you know, you're really just not being, you're being completely disingenuous. And of course, he goes into all these other things, too. And he starts talking about that Gorsuch is and this is Schlafly, he's a big supporter granting special rights to men who say they have a female gender identity. And that he sided with civil rights in 2009 by adhering to a Ninth Circuit opinion, blah, 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 blah. And he goes on and he references this case, Castle versus Maricopa County, and he joined the court's opinion, which means that, folks, in legalese, that really meant that Gorsuch didn't write the opinion. He just joined in the decision, and his signing on to the decision doesn't necessarily mean that he basically... agrees with everything that was in the opinion. And so, you know, and so Whelan gets over here and he starts cracking down on this and he says, now wait just a minute here. He goes, first of all, Schlafly misuses the Castle decision. he just gets this whole thing going out here. And said that basically that Gorsuch was sitting by designation on the Ninth Circuit during this case. So that answers a question you and I had offline.
Right.
And that he had joined an unpublished ruling that affirmed a district court's grant of summary judgment against a man who identified as female and was barred from using women's restrooms. That's not what Schlafly's analysis said.
No.
And said he supported men, you know, dressing as women, etc. However, if you look at the ruling, it affirmed the district court's grant of summary judgment against the man identifying as a female. So, in other words, this whole idea is completely backwards. Schlafly is being completely disingenuous.
And you got to ask yourself why.
Yeah.
You want my opinion? He's standing in the shadow of his mother and he's trying to make his bones.
Yeah, and I think so too. But the problem is that you've got a number of pro-life leaders in our state, and thankfully, none of whom I directly represent, because my folks, I really have pounded and kept pushing. Always look for both sides of an argument and make your decision that way.
Yeah, look,
and I'm looking at both sides of these arguments, and I mean, I know how to read judicial opinions and cases, and guess what, folks? It is definitely the weight of law and the weight of the facts are not falling in Andy Schlafly's favor.
There's a whole lot of stuff here. We're completely out of time, but there's a whole lot of stuff here that has to do. I'm going to make a statement that's probably going to get me some flack, and that is that a lot of our friends and allies are A-okay with the use of logical fallacy and also with okaying a tyrannical power as long as that tyrannical power does things that they want them to do. In other words, things that agree with their particular ideology. And Barry, that's another entire show. With that being said, I got to tell you, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. And we'd ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.